religious liberty and some of the other First Amendment freedoms, they kind of hang together.
Dr. Ryan Anderson of the Heritage Foundation talking about his presentation at the Fall 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Dallas, Texas.
That there's an ecosystem of liberty, and that what they're meant, these various natural rights that we have, they're meant to respect aspects of human dignity, the dignity of the human person to be free to live according to their conscience, to their deepest beliefs, especially beliefs about God, and therefore they're meant to promote human flourishing, that freedom is intricately connected to truth, and that living in accordance with the truth is how we flourish.
You can meet and hear Ryan Anderson making the case for our first freedoms at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference Friday, November 9th and Saturday, November 10th in Dallas. Attendance is limited to 400. Find out more and register at issuesetc.org.
Many of the feminists who have fought to break down some of the stereotypes, they're now very concerned that the transgender ideology is actually reinforcing those stereotypes. It's built upon those stereotypes.
To say something stupid like, I worship Christ and not the Bible, it really is just to say, well, I get to make up a Christ who looks just like me, and he gets to tell me what I want to hear, and therefore I'm free to ignore the parts of the Bible that my mouth and my penis and my ego don't like. Well, that's just wrong.
There is not a stronger statement of divine monergism than an infant being baptized, because the infant can do nothing for him or herself at all.
This is Flo from Idaho. Locked and loaded Lutheran ladies love listening to the straight shooters at Issues Etc.
We don't often talk about or think about the amendments to the U.S. Constitution beyond the first 10, the Bill of Rights. It gets a little boring after that. I think most of us think after you get past those big changes that defined what it means to be American for many of us. But there are a few that do get noticed. Lately, you've been hearing about the 14th Amendment, haven't you? About birthright citizenship, whether or not the president can, through executive order, vacate that part of the 14th Amendment. Is it really part of the 14th Amendment? And of course, if you remember anything about your history class, you remember the 13th Amendment that, it ratified and expanded the Emancipation Proclamation of President Lincoln. It eradicated slavery in the United States. But was there more than even that to the Civil War amendments that followed after our nation's great conflict? Welcome back to Issues Etc. Live on this Friday afternoon, November the 2nd. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. It will be part 5 of our series on the U.S. Constitution today, the Civil War amendments, with Dr. Russell Dawn. A little bit later, right at the end of the hour, we're going to play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. We've got 4 soundbites to play for you, and after we've played them, you give us a call, 1-877-623-MY-IE. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, a tweet at issuesetc, or at our Facebook fan page. We've left space for you to vote for Soundbite of the Week, facebook.com/issuesetc. We'll take your votes, and you'll decide which will be Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. Joining us for part 5 of our series on the U.S. Constitution today, the Civil War Amendments, Dr. Russell Dawn, Associate Professor of History and Political Thought and Director of the Pre-Law Program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. He holds a Juris Doctor degree from the University of Colorado, and he's a contributor to The Federalist. Dr. Dawn, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
Review for us where we've been so far.
Okay, well, we've covered the ancient and English influences on the American founding. Then we went to the specifically American context of the Constitution in terms of both the ideas that were prevalent in the American colonies and then the American states, and also the circumstances in the young republic that led to the drafting of a new Constitution. We then turned to the ways that the Constitution limits federal power. We looked at the enumeration of powers, federalism, and the Bill of Rights in the third installment, and then at legislative supremacy, the separation of powers, and checks and balances last time.
So before we talk about the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, do we have anything substantive or significant to say about the 11th and 12th Amendments?
Not much. Not that they aren't important, but they won't prove especially controversial in the development of American jurisprudence. So the 11th Amendment limits the jurisdiction of the federal courts in suits against the states. And the 12th Amendment updates the way that the Electoral College votes for president and vice president. Previously, the electors voted for two people without designating which one should be president and which one vice president. It was just vote for two people. And then the one with the most votes would be president, and the second most votes would be vice president, with some nuances there for if nobody gets the majority, etc. Under the 12th Amendment, the electors designate that they're voting for this person as president and that person as vice president.
We are going to be talking about these as Civil War amendments, so we need to explain the circumstances and the issues that led to the United States Civil War.
Sure. The two main issues at stake were slavery and states' rights. So slavery had been a divisive issue dating back to the Declaration, but that only increased with the rise of abolitionism in the 19th century. So this abolitionism was one of many reforming movements that were taking place during this era in U.S. history. And these reforming movements all sought to improve life in society progressively by bringing life more into line with Christian morality. So this was the beginning of the women's movement, for instance, and temperance and other things to make life, like I say, more in line with Christian morality. Then coming to the issue of states' rights, the question is, were the states sovereign such that they could legitimately exit the Union? In other words, withdraw from the Constitution and the Federation that it created. The Southern states argued that they could. But Abraham Lincoln knew that making participation in the Union optional would destabilize and severely weaken the Union. So those are the main issues. The circumstances were that many Northerners, including Lincoln, wanted to contain slavery in the states where it was already legal. They didn't want slavery spreading into the new territories. The Southerners, though, knew that such a restriction could mean the eventual abolition of slavery. So as new territories were created, if they all were free territories, in other words, territories where slavery is illegal, then those free territories would eventually become new free states. And if all of these new states were free states, eventually the country would be lopsided enough for a constitutional amendment making slavery illegal. When Lincoln was elected president in November of 1860, the Southern states saw this as a sign that they needed to fend for themselves, and so they seceded.
If you would talk about the Civil War and the many, and it's an extremely complicated series of events that surround it, as a genuine constitutional crisis.
Well, the Constitution itself isn't clear about whether the Union it creates is binding or optional. And the issue of how sovereign the states were in relation to each other and in relation to the federal government had never been decided. There were, from the beginning, more nationalistic opinions in competition with more federalistic or states' rights type opinions. As the Federalists in the South opted out of the Constitution through secession, the Northern Nationalists viewed the secessions as illegitimate and therefore ineffective. And so that constitutional question was really what was at stake when the shooting started at Fort Sumter. So the South began firing on Fort Sumter because there were United States troops there. And so really the question of who started the Civil War comes down to this question of the legitimacy of the secessions. If it was legitimate for South Carolina and the other states to secede, then the United States troops there at Fort Sumter were really an occupying force in a foreign country. And the Southerners who fired on it were firing legitimately. If the secessions were not legitimate under the Constitution, then really the shots fired by the Southerners were just rebellious against their legitimate government.
How were the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, we'll get into their contents in a moment, but how were they related to one another?
Well, they were all passed within 5 years after the end of the Civil War, and they were all related to attempting to recognize the equal rights of the former slaves.
What is the 13th Amendment?
Well, this amendment passed in 1865, only a matter of a few months, I think about 8 months, after the end of the Civil War and the death of President Lincoln. This amendment prohibits involuntary servitude throughout the United States. So it is the abolition of slavery through constitutional means rather than through the mere proclamation by President Lincoln that had come earlier.
So it is the ratification of the Emancipation Proclamation, which was in effect an executive order.
Yes, that's right. It's the ratification of that, but also the expansion of it, because the Emancipation Proclamation had only been aimed at the rebellious states. So there were areas that were not in rebellion or that were held by the North where the Emancipation Proclamation was not made effective. And so really it is the complete expansion of it to include all places and all governing authorities of the United States.
What is the 14th Amendment, a little more complicated amendment?
Yes, it was adopted in 1868, and it has several provisions, as you state. First, it overturns the Dred Scott decision. That decision had said that no slave or descendant of a slave can be a U.S. citizen, and that was a U.S. Supreme Court decision, truly an awful decision, not only for the matter of civil rights and natural rights, but simply constitutionally speaking. There was nothing in the Constitution that denied citizenship to descendants of slaves or to freed slaves. So it was really a rewriting of the Constitution. Well, the 14th Amendment overturns that. And it does this by its pronouncement of citizenship by birth or naturalization. It also says that no state may deprive a person of life, liberty, or property without due process. Neither may a state deny any person the equal protection of the laws. It goes on to apportioning of representatives and effectively overturning the 3/5 compromise contained in the Constitution.
Speak briefly, if you would, about how the 14th Amendment is running under it, just barely under the surface. It's dealing with practical matters, of course, but running under it is the big concern about representation in the Republic.
Yes. It's focused really on the true natural rights and natural liberty. The ideas that without these rights, without the equal protection of the laws, without being protected from losing one's life, liberty, or property without any due process, someone isn't truly free. And connected with that is that representation is really the means by which the freedom of the individual is carried out. They are represented at state levels, and they are represented at the federal level by people for whom they vote. And so without that issue of representation, there is no true equality or liberty. Furthermore, it's getting to representation by the states and within the states. So it's apportioning power among the states.
The 14th Amendment, as we speak, is actually a topic of discussion. Rarely do we see the Constitution discussed popularly, but it is today because the president has raised an issue of birthright citizenship. You'll need to explain what that is in the 14th Amendment. Some people say it's there and some people say it isn't there. But does the president have the authority that he seems to be hinting that he has to, through executive order, abolish birthright citizenship?
Yes, this is an interesting conversation. And really, the way it is couched is a little troublesome to me, that the Constitution states a right of birthright citizenship and that the president is trying to overturn that. More accurately, it's that the president is putting forth, or is going to put forth, an interpretation of the language of the 14th Amendment, that language appearing to, or at least arguably appearing to, set forth birthright citizenship. So no, Donald Trump cannot, and no president can, overturn a provision of the Constitution by executive order. But presidents can and do put forth their interpretations of and how their executive agencies will interpret provisions of the Constitution, provided that that doesn't clearly go against an established interpretation, say, established by the U.S. Supreme Court. So the question here has to do with this language. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. So the question is, what does this mean? What does it mean that someone is born or naturalized in the United States? I suppose that's clear enough. But then there's the language that says, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. And there's actually a very helpful piece in the New York Times on this. It's from John Eastman, who's a great constitutional scholar, one of my favorites. And he goes into this question of what the language of subject to the jurisdiction thereof means. And his argument, and it is probably a good argument, whether it ends up being a winning argument, I don't know. But I think it's a good argument that it means not having any allegiance to a foreign power, to another power. So subject to our jurisdiction means owing allegiance essentially only to us and not owing allegiance to a foreign power. There is material evidence that that is actually what the drafters of the 14th Amendment intended by those words. But again, whether it's a winning argument or not will remain to be seen.
So to kind of put it in crass terms, the issue here, of course, is whether or not the children born to an illegal immigrant are, by virtue of that birth in the confines of this country, automatically citizens. And Eastman is saying not necessarily so, because it could be argued they're subject to a foreign power by virtue of the citizenship of their parents. So if a royal couple came over here to Florida to spend some time on the beach and the princess happened to give birth while she was here, it would not necessarily be right to argue that that baby is a citizen of the United States as well as an heir to the crown of Great Britain.
Right. And this was a live issue at the time dealing with diplomats. There were diplomats in the United States. And if a baby was born to one of them while in the United States, then that baby was not considered to be a United States citizen because the baby was, and the baby's parents specifically, owed allegiance to another power. So yes, your description is correct.
It's part five of our series on the U.S. Constitution. Today, we're talking about the Civil War amendments. We'll talk about the 15th Amendment right after the break. Dr. Russell Dawn is our guest. He's director of the pre-law program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. The Fall 2018 Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference begin just 1 week from today at Faith Lutheran Church in Plano, Texas. Now, where else are you going to meet and hear Anthony Esselin, author of Out of the Ashes, Ryan Anderson of the Heritage Foundation, Chris Roseborough of Fighting for the Faith, John Warwick Montgomery of 1517, The Legacy Project, Beverly Yonke of Doxology, and Mark Kaltoff of Hillsdale College? Registration is $120. That includes three meals. Child care is free, courtesy of Wittenberg Academy. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 9th and Saturday, November 10th in Dallas. We'll be right back.
This was my first time going, and I was extremely thrilled with everything that was provided, from the materials to being able to meet speakers and authors of books.
Ben from Green Bay, Wisconsin, talking about the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
Thank you for putting on the conference and providing the educational material that we can use in our world today.
Learn more about our fall Making the Case conference at issuesetc.org.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod celebrates and affirms life from the time of conception until natural death, and every time in between. For this reason, LCMS Life Ministry is a program singularly devoted to upholding the sanctity of human life, both in our church body and the culture at large. Life Ministry provides educational materials, hosts conferences, and works closely with allies such as Lutherans for Life. For more information, visit lcms.org/life and follow LCMS Life Ministry on Facebook.
Smartest listeners in radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
It is the greatest adventure you could ever possibly imagine. It's demanding, it's hard, it's challenging, and what a blessing it is.
Dr. Larry Rast, president of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on why a man should consider the vocation of pastor.
And it is an incredible blessing to be honored with the opportunity to work with these incredible young men and older men as well, who are committing themselves to the proclamation of God's word, the right distinction of law and gospel, and to take the good news of Jesus Christ into all the world.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, forming servants in Jesus Christ who teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all.
The fact that he made it onto the Supreme Court should cause even more coverage. That instead they dropped it makes them seem just like Democratic partisans who care nothing about anything other than political concerns.
When somebody comes into a form of Lutheranism where they are basically saying, yeah, that law thing, that you know, we can just put that away, you don't need to hear that anymore, what they're doing is they're overreacting. They're ending up in the opposite ditch.
It's very difficult for me to explain what it meant to me to consider that I am pleasing to God not because of who I am, but because of the righteousness of Christ.
Martin Luther often said that if the church ever were to lose the biblical languages, the church would lose the gospel.
In about 15 minutes, we'll be playing Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. Those four soundbites we will play for you in their entirety, and you decide which will be Soundbite of the Week by voting for one of them. That's about 15 minutes from now. Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. In the meantime, it's part five of our series on the U.S. Constitution. We're talking about the Civil War amendments. Dr. Russell Dawn is our guest. Dr. Dawn, talk about the 15th Amendment. What is it?
This was passed in 1870, so 5 years after the end of the Civil War, and it protects the right to vote regardless of a person's race or previous condition of servitude.
You say that the Civil War amendments nationalized the federal republic. What do you mean by that?
Well, to a great extent, the Civil War and the amendments that come out of it settled the question of state sovereignty. Remember that this was a fraught issue at the time of the drafting of the Constitution. Exactly how much should we be centralizing power? How do we read the Constitution in terms of state sovereignty versus federal sovereignty? Well, these, in a way, settled it, and they settled that question in favor of the nationalists, those who would centralize power in the federal government. States are no longer as sovereign as they once were. They are subject to the rather intrusive provisions of the federal Constitution. And when I say intrusive, I'm speaking specifically of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments.
What was Lincoln's view of the Republic, and how influential was that in these amendments?
Oh, it was tremendously influential. He had a nationalist vision of the U.S., and in fact, he waged the Civil War arguably as much for the sake of holding the Union together as for limiting or ending slavery.
The relationship of the 13th, 14th, and 15th to one another, you stated before, but it also has a relationship to the 10th Amendment, given that it has to do with states as well.
Right. These three amendments are effectively a surrender to the federal government of certain powers that had been retained by the states under the 10th Amendment. So the 10th Amendment says that powers not delegated to the federal government are retained either by the states or by the people, depending on whether those rights and powers were housed in the states or in the people. So the powers that were retained but were then given up, according to the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, were determining who gets to vote. To a certain extent, that power was surrendered. Also determining the conditions under which a state may deprive a person of life, liberty, or property. It was now clear, after the 14th Amendment, that they could not do so without due process of law. And then finally, setting limits on the kinds of laws that states can adopt. They could not adopt laws that did not equally protect the people within their state.
So what legislative effects were realized after the ratification of the Civil War amendments?
Well, the amendments began a great inversion, if you will, such that the federal courts, and especially the Supreme Court, now these constitute a branch of the federal government, that these courts will exert far-reaching powers over state legislatures. So we'll talk about this inversion in detail in future discussions, but for now, the crucial point to apprehend is that, by and large, we only talk about states violating our rights under the federal Constitution because of these three amendments, and especially the 14th. So now, instead of the states having freedom to govern themselves and to experiment with the best ways of governing their own people, the federal government determines how the states can govern.
If viewed only with respect to federalism, and I don't want to be misunderstood here in your response, that when we talk about, say, a necessary evil, that we're speaking to the issue of slavery in any way whatsoever. But if only addressing the issue of federalism, were the Civil War amendments a necessary evil, so to speak?
Yes, it's a good question. And it's the sort of question that tends to go unasked because of the crucial importance of abolishing slavery. But viewed in isolation, this inversion is a negative for lovers of federalism, for lovers of states' rights under our original constitutional system. But viewed in the context of state-level abuses of all of the fundamental human rights of people of African origin, we see that this negative was absolutely necessary and therefore a net positive. So because the southern states proved that they were not capable of governing all of their people justly, they had singled out one group of people for horrifically unjust treatment, they had to surrender that governing authority. Going back to the theory behind the American War for Independence and behind the Constitution, the theory is that a self-governing people has to be a virtuous people. And the people have to govern themselves and one another justly. If they're incapable of doing that, they're incapable of that level of freedom. And so that's really what the southern states had proven. They cannot be trusted to govern themselves without intrusive and extensive oversight through the federal Constitution.
From your perspective, looking at history, and especially the way that the Constitution had kind of proven itself somewhat inadequate to the task of a fractured Union, do you think that the Civil War was inevitable?
That is a challenging question. Counterfactual history is fraught and ultimately can't work. That being said, I think that it probably wasn't inevitable because it is possible that the secessions could have stood, that President Lincoln could have decided that going to war over this would not have been worth it. And then we would have a weaker United States of America and a probably even weaker Confederate States of America coexisting next to each other. What that would look like, we don't know. How long would slavery have lasted in the Confederacy? We don't know. That is a possibility. So the war itself as inevitable, I don't think so. But the division as inevitable from the perspective of the founding and specifically the drafting of the Constitution, I think that the division probably was inevitable. It was there at the time in a more modest form, if you will, but that division was there. Many of the framers of the Constitution knew that by including the southern states and allowing slavery, they were making a deal with the devil. And deals like that often go awry.
You spoke earlier about Lincoln's nationalist view. Would you go into a little more detail about how Lincoln saw the United States of America?
Yes. Lincoln viewed the Constitution as a binding and perpetual union. He made the argument that the Articles of Confederation were called the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union, their official title, and that the Constitution was stated that it was to create a more perfect union. And a more perfect union would still be perpetual. So he viewed it very much as binding. Perhaps one could say along the lines of a marriage. One does not lightly leave a marriage. And so it was critical to the survival of the union that the union remained together without departures. He did concede very begrudgingly that perhaps if it were clear and obvious that a stated right, a right actually on the face of the Constitution, were being denied to the citizens of some states, but not to other states, that perhaps that could justify secession. But that isn't the case here, he said. And he was right. That wasn't the case there at the time. The secessions were very much preemptive. Actually, we were talking about this just this morning in class, and one of my students pointed out, this sounds like an extreme case of not my president, and as what's going on in the United States today among a lot of people. And really, that was a good description. The South, when Lincoln was elected, said, not my president to such an extent that we're going to secede.
Have the Civil War amendments, have they had the effect of making Lincoln's vision of the Constitution, that this is a permanent, unbreakable, indissoluble union, a reality?
Yes, I believe so. Really, the Civil War, to a great extent, had that effect, and then it was solidified through these three amendments.
As a follow-up, most of the attention, as you have just noted, in the Civil War amendments goes to the official abolition of slavery nationwide, but there is a much more fundamental shift in, is it too much to say, kind of the nature of the structure of our government when these amendments are passed?
It is not at all too much to say that. These are a necessary, fundamental restructuring of our constitutional system. And I say necessary again because the southern states were abusing the human rights of millions of people.
I come from Texas, and Texans regularly discuss secession as a real possibility. We even have the unofficial motto of the state is a whole other country. And you live in California, and Californians talk about that too, kind of getting fed up with the rest of the United States and ready to secede. Is that a realistic possibility in either case?
I don't believe so. Since the Civil War set the precedent that secession will be met with war, really the only way a secession could be successful is if the United States, without the seceding state, decided that that's actually better for the United States. We actually want to be rid of that state. And certainly in the cases of California and Texas, regardless of one's political disagreements, there is no way the United States would want to be without those two states. They're far too populous, far too wealthy and importantly influential, and there would just be no desire to create California as a foreign power covering the whole left side just about of the United States, and likewise with Texas making that a foreign power. So no, I don't believe it's realistic.
Dr. Russell Dawn is Associate Professor of History and Political Thought and Director of the Pre-Law Program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. He holds a Juris Doctor degree from the University of Colorado, and he's a contributor to The Federalist. Dr. Dawn, thank you.
Pleasure is mine, Todd.
LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces supports 70 active duty LCMS chaplains and 80 Reserve and National Guard chaplains who serve many LCMS young adults. You can find out more about their work at lcms.org/armedforces, lcms.org/armedforces. When we come back, it's time to play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week.
Church music directors can find a new community at Prelude to Postlude, the CPH music blog. Learn helpful tips for managing music ministry and involving members, and meet the composers of some of your favorite new pieces. Plus, find suggestions of music to use for special services, and preview some of our newest works with free samples you can use at your church. Visit us at preludetopostlude.org.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com, and like them on Facebook, facebook.com/lutheracademy.
An average of 20 military veterans kill themselves every day. Project Operation Barnabas is a network of LCMS congregations who reach out to veterans and their congregations and their communities with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces. Serving those who serve. LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. lcms.org/armedforces.
Relevant worship isn't about trying to look and act like the rest of the world to appeal to the culture around us, but relevant worship is about Christ. Hope Lutheran Church of Birmingham brings you truly relevant worship, where sinners gather to hear God's word and receive his gifts of forgiveness and peace. Visit us online at hopebham.org, that's hopebham.org, or give us a call at 205-956-1930. We'll see you Sunday.
Solid. Serious. Substantive. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Good Shepherd Lutheran, Inglewood, California. Zion Lutheran, Pleasant Plains, Illinois. Peace Lutheran, St. Louis, Missouri. Mount Olive Lutheran, Duluth, Minnesota. Bethlehem Lutheran, Parma, Ohio. Messiah Lutheran, Keller, Texas. Mount Zion Lutheran, Greenfield, Wisconsin. Emmanuel Lutheran, Eagle, Nebraska. St. Paul Lutheran, Hamel, Illinois. Our Savior's Lutheran, Ridgecrest, California. Trinity Lutheran, Fredericktown, Missouri. And Memorial Lutheran, Houston, Texas. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your church on the radio, at the website, and in the Issues Etc. journal.